Right, well, I want to welcome you guys to the penultimate writing colloquia. We only have one more after this one. Today, our speaker is Mr. Foreman. He is studying literature at the University of Dallas, and his talk will be on the use and abuse of primary texts, advice for improving your evidence.
As Ms. Niebuhr said, I'm Rhett Foreman. I'm a PhD literature student here. I work in the writing lab as well, so I'm sure every one of you has visited the writing lab, even if you haven't visited me. So today, as Ms. Niebuhr said, I'm going to talk about the use and abuse of primary texts. What I'm not going to talk about is how to use and engage secondary sources, how to do research and things like that. We're only dealing with, you know, the things themselves, Homer, you know, Iliad, Odyssey, Republic, the primary text that you guys study in the core. So Ms. Niebuhr has passed around a handout. Hopefully everyone has it, with a section from the Iliad, and then two examples on how not to treat the text, and then one example, which, in my opinion, is a fair treatment of the text. So before we get into that, that's going to be sort of the template we'll use going through that passage. But before we do that, I'm going to read the first section and discuss the first section on the handout called "A Few Don'ts." So these are rules. Things not to do when you encounter a primary text. Okay. So a few don'ts. Don't project your biases onto the text. Homer is neither Christian nor American. He's not even Nietzschean. He is certainly not Socratic. Okay, so what do I mean here? What I mean is we all have prejudices, right? We all have our own worldview that we use to interpret events in our lives, in other people's lives, current events, politics, what have you. And we don't want to assume that Homer, Dante, anybody else is looking at the world in the same light, right? All right, the second one. Don't impose technical vocabulary that isn't there. If you have no Greek, German, French, Italian, Chinese, Frisian, what have you, get some. Even a few words will awaken you to a different way of looking at the world. So, here at UD, we tend to avoid the use of jargon, right, of technical vocabulary to dissect a text. And so what I recommend is the vocabulary that you use to discuss a text should come from the text itself. So you say, oh, but, you know, we're reading Homer in translation or Dante in translation, etc. That's okay. I mean, you can, usually the translators, hopefully, you know, it's a problem, but usually the translators will sort of consistently translate the same word the same way, or you'll see the same sort of themes develop throughout the book. So my suggestion is to derive your vocabulary for discussing the work from the work itself, right? Okay, if you are able to look up, oh, well, I see, you know, Homer's talking about passion all over the place. Well, what is this word for passion, right? So then you sort of look that up, or you ask your professor, and you get the Greek word. It'd be okay to use that Greek word as a concept, right? As the thing that Homer's referring to. Okay. Of course, you want to cite your sources. You know, but again, if you don't want to use any secondary literature at all, you should still be able to get a vocabulary from the text itself instead of projecting one, some technical jargon onto the text. Okay, the third one here. Don't confuse the author with his characters. Homer is not Achilles. Homer is not Achilles. Homer is not Achilles. Okay, I think you get the point, right? So we want to make a distinction between the characters and the author. We want to make a distinction between the narrator and the author and the characters, okay? So, in other words, if Achilles makes a claim about justice, we don't want to assume that Homer would make the same claim, or that Homer is saying that we as readers should take Achilles' word, you know, for the matter. As critical readers, we need to assess to what extent we can trust the characters, to what extent the characters' views and opinions change over time. What Achilles might think about justice at the beginning of the book, you know, might be different than what he thinks about justice at the end of the book. So we can't very well say, you know, just quoting from the beginning of the book, oh, well, that's Homer's view of justice, and we can just sort of translate on that onto everything else in the text, right? So we need to make these distinctions. Okay, let's see, what's next? Don't dismiss the text as antiquated. You are not smarter just because you're a modern American who can Google stuff. You are certainly not an authority on the author's world or whatever world he has invented. We don't usually have the danger of dismissing text here at UD in this way. Part of the reason why you came here was to grapple with the primary sources themselves. But I just throw that in there, mostly to be funny. Okay. Don't dismiss the text as mere fiction, mere irony, mere rabble-rousing. Take the author seriously unless you have textual evidence to the contrary. Homer, Dante, Milton, maybe even Virgil, actually believed in what they wrote. Otherwise, you will miss out on the effect. What I mean is, you can get a lot of ideas from reading with disbelief, but without belief, you will never be able to understand the telos, that for the sake of which the text was written. Okay, so let me unpack that a bit. If you say, okay, well, Homer was a pagan, or Homer didn't really believe that, you know, there were all these gods that they were sort of directing and interfering with this war, you're going to miss out on a lot of really acute details and a lot of interesting psychology that goes on in Homer, just to take Homer as an example. Now, I understand, you know, we're not Greek pagans. But we want to, as best we can, sort of suspend, as Coleridge would say, suspend our disbelief and try to get as much as we can into the author's world, because the author, we need to understand, the author is trying to do something. He's trying to sort of go to work on us. Dante especially, Milton especially, who you'll read later on if you're still with Homer. But, you know, they have a message that they want to that they want to send. And if you're not sort of letting them lead you along, you're gonna sort of miss out on that. Now, you might get a lot of fruitful ideas, ideas that never occurred to you, but you're gonna sort of miss a lot of nuances in the book. This is about careful reading, paying attention to detail, and the telos, that for the sake of it, that's a good Greek word. Purpose is not a very good translation. The end of the work, right? Has to do with sort of the meaning, the reason for its existence. Okay, so that was my rather facetious introduction. So let's go into the example here. So now I've got an example from Homer. And this is Chapman's translation of the Iliad, or what he calls them, the Iliads. So it's probably not the one that you guys have been reading in your class, but that's okay. And so first I'm going to read the passage, read a section on how not to treat the passage, and then talk about that. So we'll do what we're not supposed to do first. Okay. So Aphrodite answered, "Haughty Tydeus, son, hath been so insolent Since he whom most my heart esteems of all my love descent, I rescued from his bloody hand. Now battle is not given to any Trojans by the Greeks, but by the Greeks to heaven. Dione answered, Daughter, think not much, though much it grieve thee. Use the patience, whereof many gods examples may produce, and bitter ills received, as well that men sustain by their inflictions as by men repaid to them again. Thy wound the foolish Diomed was so profane to give, not knowing that he that fights with heaven hath never long to live. And for this deed, he never shall have child about his knee to call him father coming home. Okay, so in this episode from book 5, Diomedes has just fought with Aeneas, and Aphrodite intrudes to rescue Aeneas, and Diomedes attacks her. And so Aphrodite, the delicate, you know, goddess of love that she is wounded and crying, and her mother, Dione, comforts her with this speech. Just a reminder, I'm sure you guys remember that passage very well. Okay. So, abuse of evidence. Okay, I'll just read it. In this episode, Homer clearly demonstrates the tension that arises when one aristocratic class, namely that of mortal men, must contend for authority against another, namely that of immortal gods. In the perennial struggle to monopolize power over the common soldier, the ruling class must assert itself over and against avaricious deities. Thus, while in some respects the Greco-Trojan conflict may appear identical to every other war wherein the working class soldier sacrifices his life, property, and well-being for the whims of the elite, in this case for a woman, Homer contributes an additional conflict, perhaps not readily apparent in Marx, that is, the conflict between the gods and aristocratic men for control of society. On the one hand, man must ultimately supplant the gods in order to ensure the class identity of the proletariat. On the other hand, man may be incapable of doing so given the gods' superior strength. But what happens when man realizes that the gods themselves are merely his own invention? Only then is he able to assert himself independently of a creator as the architect of his own society. Okay, I enjoyed writing that and reading it. Okay, this is sort of an extreme example, and then next I'll read a not so extreme example on how not to treat the evidence. So here the writer, myself, does many of the things that I recommend not doing in the list of don'ts. First, the writer projects onto the text ideas and vocabulary that are foreign to Homer. Homer had never read Marx, right? Homer didn't, you know, it's not ever explicit in Homer that he has a realist sense of, you know, class struggle or even classes, really. That's a very Marxian idea. So, now a lot of criticism, literary criticism, sort of sounds this way, where, you know, someone might use a later source to interpret and understand an earlier text, okay? Marx himself did this with literature. Freud did it, you know, reading Shakespeare and things like that. And that type of literary criticism can be interesting. It's not, however, what we want to do when we're just trying to understand the text itself, right? So in other words, we want to try to understand what Homer is saying, what Homer is doing, right? If all we're doing is spending our time projecting other people's ideas onto Homer, we're not really getting a sense of what Homer thinks about the world, right? We're sort of playing with how Marx thinks the world is, or Freud, or, you know, somebody else. So again, I don't necessarily expect that this is how y'all's papers sound, although, I mean, I haven't read all your papers. This is sort of an extreme example, but the things that I do in this paragraph can be done to greater or less extent. Okay, so projecting. The other thing we want to not do, which this this paragraph is not guilty of is assuming things about Greek culture. So back then, everyone in Greece thought that the seas represented turmoil and chaos and things in people's lives. Okay, broad generalizations. Again, don't let us assess what Homer thinks, right? So that it's sort of called historicizing. So where you think, you know, everybody in a certain age thought this way, and that is directly sort of determining what the author writes. Okay, first of all, there's no way to sort of verify that everyone in Greece thought a certain way, right? You go around today, no one can agree 100% on, you know, politics, what happened, in history, what happened last week at so-and-so's house. You know, none of us really agree 100% on anything. So we don't need to assume that all the Greeks thought the same way, right? So claims like that are really superfluous for your attempt to understand what Homer himself is saying, right? I don't think you need to have recourse to the general ideas of society at large, right? In order to read the text itself very closely and carefully, right? So if you're starting sentences back then or in ancient Greece X, I would be hesitant to do that, especially if you're not consulting any secondary sources, any people who have really studied, very closely what the Greek worldview was. Okay. Okay, so let me now read the next short paragraph, which is not too bad, but is still guilty of some of the things that we do not want to do. Okay, because of Diomedes' irreverence and sin against a god, Aphrodite's mother Dione comforts her daughter with the assurance of divine retribution. Diomedes must be punished for his impiety without the possibility of redemption. Justice, therefore, is of the utmost concern for Homer. Men must conduct warfare according to the strictest standards and remain faithful and obedient to the gods. According to this passage, therefore, man's relationship with the gods ought always to be one of subordinate to superior. Okay, so let's sort of work through this. All right, the first thing I notice about this paragraph is its use of terms that are not derived from Homer itself, that are sort of projected onto the text. Irreverence, sin, divine retribution, redemption, things like that. Now, I'm not saying, obviously the Greeks had a religion, right? And their religion consisted of concepts not entirely foreign to religions today. But we don't want to assume that Homer would take those ideas in the same light, right? So be very careful incorporating language such as this, or any language that comes from a more modern vocabulary when you discuss a text, okay? What else? Okay, so okay, the other thing about this this passage is it does not address any sort of counter argument, any interpretation of the passage that would contradict this writer's viewpoint, right? So it's always good to assert your thesis or your interpretation of a passage over and against another plausible interpretation, right? What that does is it shows that you are thinking critically about a text, and you know that your reading of it is up for dispute. You want to defend your own argument, I'm not saying, okay, but incorporating a counter-argument and then defending yourself against the counter-argument does not undermine your position. It actually makes it stronger, right? It makes your argument more convincing, okay? So this person has sort of, this writer here is sort of a one-track mind, thinking in kind of this box, translating his own worldview onto the text. Okay? What else is there? Okay, the other thing I see here, justice therefore is of the utmost concern for Homer. So again, going back to the list of don'ts, the writer has confused the character with the author, right? This rather minor god, this minor character, Dione, in the Iliad. You know, the speaker here is taking Homer's view of justice from Dione. It would take a lot to justify that, especially with a character so minor as Dione. It's not at all clear that Homer himself thinks that Diomedes should be punished for attacking Aphrodite. If you remember in that section, Athena is the one who encourages Diomedes to attack Aeneas, attack Aphrodite. So a god is behind all this. So we can't really say that Homer would take the side of Dione versus, you know, the side of Athena. I'm not saying he would take Athena's side either. I'm just saying, right, we can't assume that Dione's view is what Homer would do. Another thing to think about. Okay, think about what's happening in this exchange. It's a mother and a daughter, right? The mother is going to say things that might not necessarily be 100% true in order to comfort her daughter. Maybe they are true, but she's going to put them in a certain light, right? She's not going to want to say, oh, Aphrodite, you shouldn't have, you know, it's all your fault. You're the goddess of love. What were you doing on the battlefield? You know, some people's parents might comfort them in that way. That's not the tactic Dione uses, right? So we can't assume that we can trust Dione 100%, right? When she has this sort of ulterior motive, okay? Okay, so now that we've gone through these two passages, well, actually, I've got a couple more things to say about citing a passage itself, okay? Now, a lot of different professors expect different things. Some people are okay with block quotes. Some people don't want block quotes. Some people want a paraphrase of the text and, you know, no quotation. They want you to put it in your own words. Okay, it's your job as a student to figure out what your professor wants in terms of quotation, how your professor wants things quoted. Okay, so I'm just going to sort of give you a few general rules, but you always want to make sure you check with your professor. Okay, so there's always this question, how much should I cite? Okay, what's too much? What's too little? Okay, it's complicated, right? The best answer is, well, however much you need to, in order to get the job done, right? Here I've got a relatively long passage. Also wanted to give you guys some context. You know, personally, I would rather see someone quote one passage and really pick it apart, really ask questions of the text, rather than, you know, a lot of little passages, you know, scattered here and there, right? Don't just quote things just to get quotes in, right? Quote things that you are going to very carefully analyze, and I'm going to talk about how to do that in a minute. You know, the other thing to keep in mind is what it looks like for your reader, right? Think about how easy or difficult it's going to be for a reader to read this paper. Okay, if you have a string of little quotes you know, in one paragraph, you've got three, four, you know, one sentence quotes or little phrases. That's going to be very disorienting for the reader, right? Because the reader's not going to necessarily understand what exactly you're trying to say with that quotation, because you haven't really spent enough time on it, right? You know, visually, a lot of times I think the block quote looks better. So I can quote all this, you know, not too much, but a nice paragraph or two. And then I don't have to worry about having all these quotation marks, these citations, all this stuff. I can just analyze the text in the body of the paragraph itself. You know, a lot of citations, right? A lot of those parenthetical citations, they're visually distracting for the reader, right? It's you know, so someone's trying to follow along with your argument, and all of a sudden there's like all these roadblocks. There's all these roadblocks in the way, right? So this is all just to say, you know, preferably in general, generally speaking, don't deal with more than one quotation in at least a paragraph, right? It would be my recommendation. Or at least have your quotation separated out enough with enough analysis in between, that it will show your reader that you're really examining the passage. Okay. Yeah, you don't want to clutter up. You don't want to clutter up your paper with a lot of different quotes, right? So now let's go on to now that we've talked about how not to use evidence, let's talk about how to use evidence, how to analyze text. Some of the things I've been talking about. Okay. So first, we'll read this section under use of evidence. Shouldn't Dione be angrier with Athena, the goddess who incited Diomedes against her daughter, than with Diomedes himself? Indeed, even Diomedes should condemn Athena, since her encouragement led to an overestimation of his stature, an overestimation which may contribute to his own demise. While some may argue that Diomedes deserves retribution, I contend that Dione's own argument works against her. The gods, who not only pit man against man, but also god against god and man against god, as Dione indicates, are hardly worthy of trust or respect. In a war in which the gods are as divided as the men will necessarily be forced to favor some gods over others. True, Diomedes may be a fool for attacking an immortal. Certainly, his attack against Apollo is unwarranted and denotes the limits of how far man might struggle against the gods. But that is not to say that he has acted impiously against Athena. In this scene, Homer appears to question whether piety has any meaning at all in the context of a battle, and whether men ought strictly to abide by their usual role of subordination to the gods, since war brings out the worst in mortal and immortal alike. Okay, so this is... it's sort of an extreme position, but it's not wholly unjustified, right? And one could imagine that the thesis here about, you know, the dubious state of piety in times of war, you know, a thesis about that could be developed sufficiently in a larger conversation than just what we have here. So again, it's a little bit radical, right? It would take a lot of justifying, but it's at least interesting and compelling and not wholly unprovable, okay? So let's work through and see what I do here with the writer, what I do here. That is a fairer treatment of the text that we have. Okay, so notice the first thing the writer does is ask a question of the text. And a lot of things, that's something I would really recommend you guys do. Even if you don't incorporate text in your writing, which I don't think there's any reason why you shouldn't, in your outlining process, your thinking process, you should at least be asking a lot of questions of the text. A lot of people come to the writing lab and they just really haven't been asking questions, right? they're trying to come up with, I don't know. What happens is, if you don't ask questions, really all you end up doing is making observations. You get in, you know, summary land, and I'm sure, I'm guilty of it. A lot of people have been guilty of it, you know, giving too much summary of a text and not enough argument about the text, argument about what the text is saying. So asking questions, which you can then come up with plausible arguments, answers for, is a way to develop strong, you know, sort of controversial positions. So the first thing the author does here is ask a question after the quote. Okay, now sometimes it's okay once you have a quote to have a summary, especially if it's a very sort of confusing, difficult text. You know, what ideally the author would want to do is provide some background, some context for this episode, right? Like I've done in my talk, what's been happening in the book, right? And then go into a more detailed analysis, right? If it's a very difficult text, if you're dealing with Plato or something, you know, then you really want to sort of have, it's okay to make to have a brief summary, you know, before you start into the analysis, just so you can let the reader know, okay, this is, you know, the gist of what the author is saying, okay? But then after that, ask yourself some questions and then see what kind of answers you might come up with, okay? Okay, so what else do we have? Okay, in the third sentence, while some may argue that Diomedes deserves retribution, I contend that Diomedes' own argument works against her. Okay, so this is the counter-argument argument device that I was mentioning in the previous passage with the previous author did not do. So again, as you can see here, it's all it takes is a clause. Now you can develop that. I wanted to keep it sort of brief for this presentation, but you know, one could have a whole sentence dedicated to a counter argument. Some people think this, many people think this, you know, some may interpret this. Okay, how do you come up with a counter argument? First thing you need to do is ask questions, right? Ask questions, figure out what your answer is, and then figure out what somebody else's answer might be. Okay? Now, you can have counter arguments just as sort of, for the matter of convenience, I'll outline two different types of counter-arguments. You can have a counter-argument that is an alternative interpretation of a passage that you present, right? You could also have a counter-argument that is an alternative thesis, okay? Ideally, in your paper, you want to have sort of a mixture of both. So here, this is sort of an alternative take on the passage itself, not necessarily an alternative thesis, right? What somebody else would make an entire paper out of. It's just a different way of understanding the passage. While some may argue that Diomedes deserves retribution, I contend that Diomedes' own argument works against her. I'm just talking about this episode right here, what Diomedes is saying, okay? Okay, then what happens? Okay, so one of the things Dr. Kreider talks about in the Office of Assertion, which I cited at the bottom of the page there, is, you know, two different ways of making arguments: analysis and synthesis. So, you know, first, what the author does here is have a sort of a close analysis of this particular passage, okay? And then the author sort of alludes to the broader context. So we have the analysis, and then we have the synthesis, right? Synthesizing this particular passage with the context, you know, in which it appears, or with the book as a whole. I don't exactly discuss the book as a whole here, although I do talk about in the lessons, you know, what Homer sort of thinks. But as you can see, As you can see in this, in one of the sentences here, true Diomedes might be a fool for attacking an immortal. Certainly his attack against Apollo is unwarranted and denotes the limits of how far man might struggle against the gods. Okay, and I have a separate citation for that. That's not something that I've quoted. I'm referencing another episode. Okay, so to remind you what happened in Homer, after Diomedes attacks Aphrodite, Apollo comes in, and Diomedes starts to attack Apollo, and Apollo says, "Whoa, bud, I'm not Aphrodite. I'm a bit stronger than she is. I don't think you want to come up against me." So that's the other episode that I'm referencing here. So this is a way to incorporate other sections of the text without having sort of direct quotations, right? Without having a lot of different quotations. You see what I mean? And it synthesizes what your analysis of this particular passage with another section of the text in order to draw on the implications of this passage for the broader context or for the work as a whole. Okay? So analysis and synthesis, and that's right out of Dr. Kreider's book there. Okay, what else do I have to talk about? In the last sentence, in this scene, Homer appears to question whether piety has any meaning at all in the context of battle, and whether men ought strictly to abide by the usual role of subordination to the gods, since war brings out the worst in mortal and immortal alike. Okay, so one could imagine that sentence needs some justification, right? We would, in the rest of this paper, go about sort of justifying that. But I wanted to give you sort of an example of how to synthesize what your analysis of one particular passage might mean for the work as a whole. Okay. Okay, so let's go back to Yes.
We're gonna have time for questions.
Okay, we can do that. Yeah.
He doesn't have to be ready.
We've got. One more item. Okay, so let me talk about defining terms, because I talked a lot about how you don't want to project language onto your analysis of a text that doesn't really come from the text itself, right? So let's talk about how to define the language that you're using to interpret a text, right? Which hopefully comes from Homer, or comes from Dante, or comes from the text itself. Okay, so what you don't want to do is resort to, and again, Dr. Kreider talks about a lot of this stuff in the Office of Assertion, which I highly recommend to you. What you don't want to resort to is sort of a dictionary definition, right? Well, in the Oxford English Dictionary, justice is defined as blah, 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 blah. And then you take that idea of justice as a way to, weigh the justice or Homer's justice, okay? When we talk about a definition, we want the definition to be commensurate with the author's understanding, the author's usage, right? So Dr. Kreider talks about genus and species, and I don't know if some of you have heard that talk before. So in your first part of a definition, you would discuss, so justice. Well, what type of thing is justice, right? What type of thing is it? Well, justice is a, someone could say, so justice is a virtue, so that's sort of the type of thing it is. Justice is a virtue, right? But it's not the only virtue, it's a virtue. Okay, so then what type of virtue is it, right? So you have the broad category, which is the genus, and then you have, the specific category, which is the species. Well, justice is a virtue, justice is a civic virtue, it has to do with the city, right? Something like that, the polis, But again, we want to talk about, that would be maybe a Platonic understanding. If I was writing a paper on Plato, I would want to sort of clarify what I was... what I was meaning by justice, right? Homer might mean something else by justice. So you want to sort of really analyze the text and then present the author's understanding of these terms, right? It's difficult. None of this stuff is like easy to do, right? But that's why you're at your UD, right? So let's go. Let me take some questions if anybody has any. Any points of clarification? Yes.
I was wondering, when you were talking about historicizing.
Yes.
Is it possible to use common, historical facts from the time to clarify points, or is it never a good idea?
Well, first of all, I never want to say never, right? I want to qualify everything. I would say it depends on the context, but I really would err on the side of not doing it, especially when the paper is meant to for you to explore the text itself, to understand, Homer himself. Now, there might be some term or something that refers to, an invention back then that no one now would know what it means at all, and you need sort of some clarification. Okay, when in doubt, ask your professor, hey, would it be okay if I clarify this term, because it really is specific to that time and place in history, right? But when you're dealing with broader ideas, what Homer thinks about this and that, I don't know that you need. For our purposes, I don't know that you need recourse to any sort of outside understanding of what the culture as a whole thought. And things like, just to let the reader know, Greeks were pagans. Well, that's, things like that are sort of understood, right? Greeks didn't know there was an America. Well, yeah. Okay.
I wanted to reiterate and to just celebrate the idea that it's okay to slow down and comment on what you quote.
Oh, yeah.
And moreover, it's really good to choose carefully what you quote, and not just to throw in quotations for the sake of quotations.
That's right.
That's so important. And it's also really important to be mindful, the other fantastic thing you said, that what's the context? Who's talking? Is it the character talking? Is it the narrator talking? And to be able to sometimes give a little, even context to introducing it, to say, when Achilles says, that this might even reflect Homer's bigger idea in the poem, which is doing something very sophisticated because you're actually making explicit something and not assuming it, and that's great. I did want to just jump in and say I'm one of those professors who does not allow you to use block quotes and who encourages lots of little quotes. And I'll say, if you do use a block quote, it has to be really, really, really important. The whole paper has to be about it. And even then, I still want you to be quoting all the terms, the page numbers, the phrases, just because as a reader, when I see a big block quote, I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking at often.
Right.
And so to really use it well requires a lot of skill. So I just wanted to throw that out there. You did so well say, check with your professor, but just so you know, I'm one of the professors that says, don't do block quotes, and use lots of little ones, especially if they are the same passage, or if they're not just like pulled from everywhere, because I agree with I know what you're talking about, like the pepper and salt stuff, like just, let's throw quotes in here. But sometimes it's when you're leading your reader through a line or through something, and you just want to make sure you take the magnifying glass and say, here, you and I might be actually dealing with the same passage. We might want to be focusing on that passage that you gave us. But there's actually a way of doing that using little quotes too.
Sure. Yeah, and I think what you say about going back and referencing the language of the text itself. I mean, do that as much as you need to, right? I mean, that really shows that you are dealing with the stuff that you quote. You're not sort of trying to prove something else, and then as an afterthought, you just search through the book and found some quotes. I know that's what a lot of people do, right? You want the genesis of your paper to be particular text, particular quotes. So those are the quotes that you would need to use. Anybody else? Ms. Niever, yeah.
I wonder if you could talk just really quickly about the selection of evidence. So
yes.
Okay. Let's say you have some assignments at UN where I expect students to focus on simile, and so they pick a simile and they put that in, and so there's some sense selection can be for them. But a lot of us give prompts that are more broad, thematic.
Right.
What is justice in the Odyssey or the Iliad, something like that. How would you advise students on selecting?
Right. Okay. What I recommend is pick a passage that you don't understand, that you're confused about. Okay, so if the professor gives, I want you to write on heroism in Homer, in the Iliad. I mean, were there any points in your reading where you thought, well, I don't know if that action was admirable. It, you know, Achilles is supposed to be sort of a hero, but I don't know if that action was admirable. That would be the moment that you would want to zero in on and discuss, because you're going to get a lot of questions out of that. If you're confused by something, you're going to have a lot of questions. It's going to be difficult. Right? Like I said, a lot of this is difficult. But those are the controversial moments. Right? Those are the moments that make theses, that make arguments. If you're not really perplexed by something in reference to a particular topic, you know, if that doesn't work for you, relevancy, of course. Go ahead. If your professor is given the general theme, make sure your selections are relevant, that speak to that theme. Preferably, if the quotations use language, you know, that's a lot of what I talk about. Use language that you would adopt, you know, in order to interpret the text. You know, in this. You know, if you write a paper on piety and the word piety appears, you know, in a particular passage, that's the passage that you would want to pick, right?
Can I just jump in also? Mm-hmm. I notice that sometimes students have a hard time identifying what they're claiming. They think they're claiming something, and actually they're just giving summary.
Right.
And other times, they think they're summarizing and they're actually have a claim. And often the claim is that's a really hard thing to discern. Once you figure out what your claim is, once you're figuring out what you're arguing, what your point is, your quotations should really be the things that convince your reader to believe you about that. So you don't need the quotation to argue that Achilles, you know, used a shield. Unless it's a paper talking about weapons and war, and you know, and then the shield quote is really important. And if you're making the case that, you know, etc., if you're talking about piety, which is great, yeah. See, who's talking? Who's pious? What are they saying about the god? What's the relationship with the god? What kind of piety? Which brings us back exactly what you were saying. Well, we can't just assume what piety is. We want to see what Homer is showing us what piety is. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is the quotes that are going to illustrate what you have to say about piety. So try to keep your eye on the prize. What's your claim, and how's the text, how are the little bits and pieces, or even a key scene, if you want to quote as a blog, are going to make your reader believe what you have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, as an aside to that, I think it is profitable to present an episode or a quote that might go against what you're saying in order to just sort of prove the rule, right? The exception might prove the rule. So if you see that, Odysseus is always faithful to Penelope. Well, he's not always faithful to Penelope, but but Odysseus, you know, on the island with Calypso, you might be able to use that in your favor to prove Odysseus's fidelity, because he talks a lot about how Penelope was on his mind the whole time, etc. Right? So don't ignore passages because you think they might undermine your argument. Because those are the things your professor's going to write on your paper, but you didn't think about this, right?
In other words, the little themes that are surrounding your point can be the opposite, as well. The counter argument is also about your argument.
Right.
That's exactly
right.
This is Mabel.
Well, thank you all for coming on this weary day.